I got like a couple of announcements of my own. First, a disclaimer about this slideshow. It is exceedingly silly, so forgive me for that. Second, if you have hopefully pre-fashioned your tinfoil hats, feel free to pop those on whenever you're overwhelmed by the feeling that Google is listening to your thoughts. One last disclaimer is that I am not a tech expert and never claimed to be, but neither is Shoshana Zuboff, and she wrote an 800-page book about this topic, so I feel about as qualified as her to talk about it. And obviously there is a lot of politics behind this. It's not just the kind of tech stuff. So what is this talk about? Well, it's mainly going to be about the contents of this book, to be honest. I personally don't really like the term surveillance capitalism that Zuboff coined. It's meant to imply a shift to a new type of capitalism, which differs fundamentally from the previous form of capitalism. So she thinks it has a sort of totally new logic of accumulation, new drives, new social divisions, and so on. And to illustrate that transformation, she spends a lot of time in her book really talking up the democratic, humane, dynamic capitalism, supposedly, of the 20th century, as against the new, inherently undemocratic surveillance capitalism. And I really don't think there's any evidence for that kind of division. You know, industrial capitalism before this century, which was just as interested in surveying workers, states acted just as undemocratically and used technology, whatever technology they could get their hands on, you know, including CCTV, which has been around for about 7 years now, or 6 years, sorry. Used whatever they could to spy on and control their populations. Even before they had technology like that, the capitalist system was doing that to try and control its populations. But I do think there's some usefulness in going through some of the stuff that Shoshana Zuboff talks about. You can talk about a kind of new surveillance capitalists, a whole industry whose business model involves large-scale data mining, behavior prediction products, and at times, I think, attempts to tune or modify human behavior through digital technologies for their own profits. And the companies that are the most kind of guilty of this are the FAMG, which is a terrible acronym, which stands for Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon's in there as well, and Google. So in this, I'm going to go through a bit of the history, some of the stuff that Zuboff traces. I'll go through some of the horror examples of what this brave new world looks like. And then we can talk as well about, you know, what this means for resistance, for struggle, and for what society could look like in the future. So, okay, it's a bit of a weird slide. So our story starts with the NSA and the CIA acting basically as venture capitalists. They set up a venture capitalist firm in Silicon Valley. They weren't the only ones doing this, obviously. They were just independent investors doing the same. And they both, the CIA and NSA, awarded very large funds to computer science researchers at the top US tech universities. And they were interested in, this is in the 1990s, I should say, interested in supercomputing and the analysis of large amounts of data that was made possible by, obviously, computers on the one hand and the internet. So in 1993, the whole intelligence community came together and wrote a white paper. They declared that the intelligence community needs to process large volumes of data and needs to take a proactive role in funding research in the efficient management of massive databases. And they said, this is a direct quote, ensuring that the intelligence community requirements can be incorporated or adapted into commercial products is a high priority. And from there, and Google, actually, the guys who started Google were some of the people who received a lot of this funding, and then went on to, obviously, form private companies like Google in the mid-1990s. So from the start, there's a pretty cozy relationship between the government and, you know, much more sort of nefarious forms of surveillance and corporations like Google. So then two things happened in the early 2000s. The first, and this is a terrible, diagram I tried to make, hopefully it makes some sense, but this is, Zuboff calls this the discovery of behavioural surplus, which I think is a bit of a silly term in some ways. I think the easier way to put it is that Google discovers in the early 2000s a more profitable business model than what they'd been doing before. What they'd been doing before was just what kind of makes sense is you sell your software to people and to other companies. So Google would sell its little Google search engine to websites and they collected data, but that was really just to improve the search service. So what they discover is a much more profitable way to go about it is to give the software out for free to basically everyone and then mine the data that resulted from people interacting with it. So people searching and clicking and whatever, you get surplus data about our behavior, or just data. I don't know why it has to be surplus particularly, but data about our behavior. And then package that up as predictive products using using computation to sell to other capitalists, basically, not to us, as a sophisticated new form of advertising. And this really took the guessing game out of advertising. You could have a much clearer idea of what, you know, how to target ads and that sort of thing, and so on. So, yeah. So the other thing that happened was 9/11 and the resulting Patriot Act. And this was hastily passed 45 days after 9/11, obviously in the name of national security. And many countries had similar surveillance laws that were passed. And, you know, the Patriot Act was just the first one of many, really. And this made it easier for governments to spy on phone and email communications, collect bank and credit reporting records, and track the activity of ordinary people. And the Australian government, both Howard and the Labor Rudd Gillard government's pace also passed an insane number of surveillance laws at this time. So the reason this is connected to Google is that it also helped establish a virtually lawless industry for big tech, where no invasion of privacy was beyond the pale. So from the start, the Valley and government was really closely integrated. And one example of this is the relationship between Google and the Obama administration. So Google helped Obama win his 2008 election campaign. They compiled data using all of this new tech on 250 million Americans, so, you know, pretty much all voting Americans, and used predictive data tools to figure out exactly how to nudge them into voting for Obama, you know, show them an ad at the right moment, whatever. And they were even more prominent in the 2012 election as well. So they knew by then they could figure out the names and profiles of every single person who Obama still hadn't convinced to vote for him and figure out, again, how to target ads at them. So, I mean, I raise this not because I think, like, oh, this is why Obama won the election or whatever, but I just think it is worth understanding how, you know, tightly related the kind of executives of these corporations are with government. And also, you know, it's something to bear in mind when you hear all the insufferable crap from Democrats about how Russian bots stole the 2016 election and, you know, it's all terribly unfair or whatever. Obviously, yeah, Google was actually a lot better at that than Russian bots. So this is here. This is Eric Schmidt with Obama. The other thing that's interesting about the Obama administration, just as a side note, is that there's a really rotating door between Google execs and members of the Obama administration. So 197 people went from government to work at Google, and 61 went the other way from Google to work in his administration. Okay, so back to the data mining stuff. Google and the companies that followed in its wake, the ones that I mentioned, you can see them there, were able to grow extremely rich from this business model. Google went from, in the early thousands, basically being on the verge of bankruptcy to one of the most highly valued stocks and corporations in the world. I guess the question is why, in a way, like why was it so lucrative? I think part of the reason is it's just a way of acting parasitically, in a way, on the rest of industry, just as advertising does generally. So Google and, you know, the other companies that do similar things force the rest of the capitalist class to hand over a bunch of their profits just so they aren't cut out of the advertising market and cut out of the market entirely. Now, obviously, these corporations as well produce other highly profitable commodities that aren't, Google is Alphabet. They produce other highly profitable commodities that aren't just about surveillance and data. You know, iPhones, Alexa, Google Home, computers, obviously, in the case of Microsoft. And these obviously, you know, are produced in factories, involve an enormous amount of capital, lots of labourers. You know, one Apple factory in China has about 230,000 workers. So it's certainly not all down to this data mining stuff. But interestingly, these devices are most lucrative when they allow the companies to mine ever greater sources of raw behavioural data. Okay, this is a bit, you don't really need to look at this, but the drive of these big five and also, you know, internet service providers and like Verizon that got on board, for endless reams of data has in part been the driving force behind a really rapid concentration and centralization of the tech industry, which I think really should have quashed already any idea that the internet is inherently decentralized and democratic, which was kind of the utopian vision people had of it in the early days, that it was, you know, information wants to be free and inherently is just not, can't be controlled by capital. That's just been firmly disproven by the last 20 years. Google acquired more than one company per week in 2010 and 2011, and it's acquired hundreds since. So as a consequence, all these five companies that I talked about are the richest in the world, and they completely dominate their field. So this is an enormous concentration of wealth and power. It's not unprecedented in this. Obviously, capitalism just has a tendency to centralize and concentrate capital and power and create huge monopolies. But they are, you know, extremely big and unprecedented in scale in a way. But I don't think that makes it a new type of capitalism or whatever. So some of the awful ramifications of this kind of this surveillance capitalism or surveillance capital industry, whatever you want to call it. The first is Pokemon Go, which was the real product wasn't really the game, which I don't really get why people play it. It's not very fun. But anyway, the real product was the ability for corporations to pay to attract rare digital Pokemon to their location and therefore attract players who would, you know, basically spend money in Starbucks or whatever it is. And so Financial Times called this when it came out a cash cow, and it became a really profitable company overnight, basically. Macca's, Starbucks, all these malls had huge deals with Pokemon Go. And it didn't last very long because eventually people like got bored of the game. But I think it did show what some of the practical applications of this are, like an attempt to just monetize absolutely everything. Every, you know, little game and joy in the world becomes about, you know, dragging people into a net, a commercial net where they spend more money. And you've got, yeah, there's a little fact there as well about the guy who wrote it, of course, who has, you know, some ridiculous connection to the CIA. Okay, another thing is the bloody Alexas and all of the recording devices. And again, I think this is really about monetizing every moment of your life, not actually necessarily helping you that much. They record conversations that then get fed into machine learning algorithms in order to better understand human behavior and, again, further monetize it. And there's a bunch of court cases at the moment about these devices just activating like in the middle of the night and recording people without their consent. Amazon even had human workers sifting through recorded conversations, like listening to recorded conversations recorded without people's consent to supposedly help improve the algorithms. So creepy stuff. I think one of the worst applications of this is in the insurance industry. It's kind of a perfect application because insurance companies are essentially, they make a bet on the likelihood of various outcomes. You know, the likelihood that a fire will burn down your house or you'll have a heart attack or die in a car crash. It's a sort of sadistic form of capitalist fortune telling in a way that particularly festers when there's an absence of freely provided social services. So hospitals aren't free, you buy health insurance. And most of the time, this industry involves quite a lot of guesswork and generalizations. You know, your premiums will be higher if you are an older person with a heart condition, or for car insurance, it'll be higher if you're a young driver. So the new data mining and prediction products allows for the fine tuning of this, which I think can be pretty sinister. And there's been a whole bunch of attempts to introduce this. So trackers in your smart car, for example, that raise your premiums if you drive too fast or can just turn your car off if you break some rule. Health insurers that force you to wear a Fitbit and raise your premiums if you don't walk enough or have enough steps each day or whatever. And a famous example of this was the West Virginia teachers who went on strike. And one of the things that really fired them up was that there was a bill that would require them to wear Fitbit trackers, otherwise their healthcare costs would increase. So again, really sinister stuff. I think the worst bit though, so the worst kind of application is actually widespread surveillance in the workplace. And this is obviously not new to the 21st century, but it is, I guess, a lot easier to go about it with this kind of technology. So there's companies, for example, I'll get to this staff cop thing eventually, but there's companies that predict an employee's flight risk based on mining their social media and other accounts for data, and then they sell that data secretly onto employers. And the employers can then do what they want with it. They can preemptively sack workers. It's sort of like thought crime. You know, you look like you might want to suddenly quit or have a baby or something, and your employer can sort of predict that and sack you in advance. Amazon is really renowned for creepy monitoring of their workers. They have vans that feature a four-part camera with biometric feedback indicators, whatever that means. Warehouse workers who are tracked to pinpoint exactly how much time they spend off task. Whole Foods was quite a famous example. It was acquired by Amazon, and it kept track of dozens of factors, which allowed them to predict the likelihood of a unionization drive happening in each Whole Foods outlet. And then they produced from that a unionization threat heat map and went and did God knows what to the workers who, you know, were becoming, again, predicted to form a union. And work from home during the pandemic has really allowed this stuff to flourish. So surveillance software use grew by 50% in workplaces last year, and I'm sure it's grown more since then. And some of the dystopic names of these companies that produce this software are things like, you can see here, Staff Cop, and I just got that from their website because I thought it was creepy. One's called Clever Control, one's called Controlio, like, you just make it a cute little name and you forget that it's got control in the title. Some allow remote control of webcams and microphones while you're at work, so it can look around your home and pry into your private life. Others measure keystrokes, so you get keystroke rates that get sent to your bosses. Some monitor private messages on social media chat or take random screenshots of the desktop to make sure you're working. One application called NetVisor claims that it operates entirely in stealth, invisible to the consumer. And there's things like called FlexiSpy and SpyTech as well, which literally just tap the phones of employees. So again, I don't think this is new. In a way, it's kind of a new Taylorism. If people don't know what Taylorism is, at the turn of the 20th century, there's an attempt to basically measure the exact time it took the average worker on a production line to complete each task in order to minimize wasted time and help actually justify the speed up of work and increases in productivity. And that's always something that capitalists are trying to do. Now they have this to help them with that. And Zuboff basically argues that the reason this is introduced into workplaces is because it's sort of a captive audience where you can have a test case to launch this tech, but the real idea is to launch it on the rest of society. I think that can be true in some ways, but I think there's an end in it in itself in introducing this into the workplace, obviously, because workplaces are the actual engine of economic growth in society, and making us more malleable, controllable, and productive at work is a key aim for all capitalists. Some more creepy stuff. So Facebook also conducts social experiments on its millions of users without their consent or awareness, and they've reportedly conducted thousands of such experiments and had, you know, a few court cases over it. And this usually involves manipulating what users see on their wall, giving them fake things to see on their wall. And these studies, interestingly, are collaborations with university research teams. And so they get published in the top psychological journals, but they don't have to meet any of the same standards or go before an ethics board or anything. So one researcher called this approach review board laundering, where you use, a private connection to Facebook or some other big data company, and you don't have to be ethical at all in the social experiments you're conducting. And this one, emotional contagion, was a secret experiment they conducted on millions of users, and it just showed that people are human beings who empathize with each other. And immediately after this was published, all these companies are like, oh, great, how can we use this to make money, preying on the fact that people actually have empathy for each other. Now, probably the most terrifying potential Use of this is the idea of a social credit system, a live updated score computed from a wide range of data about us. Now, I think this already exists in many ways. Uber and Deliveroo drivers have a score they need to maintain just to stay in their job, and it's affected by every single customer rating they get. Credit checks have been around for a long time, but big data has allowed for more rigorous tracing systems, which just, you know a lot about you and your entire financial history. And there's some more sinister things being introduced as well, like the US wants to introduce radicalism scores, which would be known to law enforcement, which are computed from things you post on social media, your searches, whatever. Yeah, yep, the meow meow beans app for sure. Yeah, so the radicalism score thing, should terrify everyone. Obviously, right now that's being talked about as this is to stop Capitol Hill rioter types. But, I mean, radicalism is radicalism, and people who want to overthrow the capitalist system have often been called radical as well with good reason. So, yeah, there's heaps of other examples, but I'll skip those. The best known society-wide social credit system is that has been attempted to be introduced in China. It was first trialed as an opt-in system in 2014, and it judges citizens' behaviour, you know, everything from facial recognition software, which might catch you jaywalking, or, you know, if you default on a debt, that becomes part of the score. It knows who your friends are and judges you based on those connections. It's like the digital equivalent of your parents telling you not to fall in with the wrong crowd or whatever. Any behaviour deemed antisocial, playing loud music, letting your dog off the leash, etc., can affect your score. And then they can also have just automatic punishments dished out, which don't require it going through a court or anything. So you might not be able to buy transport tickets. You might not be able to take out a loan. You might not be refused employment or excluded from particular schools. They can even apparently just make your internet connection slow, which is a horrifying punishment. As yet, the system hasn't come together completely. There are a series of local systems controlled by local Communist Party governments and some controlled by private businesses. But essentially what it looks like is a blacklist with millions of people on it, which is horrifying. I don't think it means that, this is 1984, no one can resist or whatever. But obviously this is a really disgusting and horrific form of social control, which I think lots of capitalist societies would love to introduce. And plenty of China's allies actually have been like, oh, can we, China's basically offering to build a similar system for countries like Vietnam and Cambodia as a bit of a quid pro quo with them. Okay, bit of a random change of tone. I guess just to say that, you know, Snowden's leaks also showed that this wasn't, you know, this a lot of this kind of thing is happening across the whole world, and particularly the NSA can do some pretty horrendous things if they want to spy on individual civilians, and they can do that essentially without a warrant. So they can take command of people's devices to the extent that they can see you while you're typing, even if you delete it and never send it. Which I find really creepy for some reason. They can have widespread warrantless phone tapping and other forms of surveillance, things that like where they turn on your device without you knowing and can watch you through the webcam, things like that. And again, a lot of this is without warrant. And there's actually a new attempt, again, with the justification about the Capitol Hill riot. There's a Democrat, Republican, whatever they're called, like Congress, I can't remember what it's called now. Anyway, some like group, a bipartisan group in Congress that is trying to basically introduce new laws that would allow for the dredging up of data and content from Facebook, TikTok, everything to put people on a watch list if they like questioned the result of the election last year. Which, I mean, for one thing, is not going to actually stop the rise of the far right. It misplaces the cause of the far right as though it's just because there's new technologies and they can talk to each other or whatever. And obviously this should be of concern to anybody who ever says anything seditious, which includes the whole left. Okay, so to move on, I wanted to talk about the kind of different versions of tech utopia, I guess, that are floated both by the tech leaders, the people who run Google and so on, and also by, I just wanted to introduce Paul Mason and David Harvey that have quite a bit to say about this as well. So to start with the Zuckerberg types, they envisage a smart society full of smart things that are fully integrated with people and operate according to rules and plans that are laid out by experts. So basically they envisage a society ruled by experts, where those expert rulings are then carried out sort of automatically by machines. And I think, their vision is really not that different to some of the, well, it's a more dystopic version of some of the utopian socialists in the early part of the 19th century, who envisaged a world basically run by smart but caring elites who know what's best for us. And the CEO of Microsoft paints this picture of a new data-driven world of work as well, because they've reimagined the whole world of work. He says our jobs would be enriched by productivity. And obviously, he says, hopefully the wages would go up, which is just wrong. Making workers more productive is not going to deliver higher wages. Often it lowers them. And in a speech, he invites us to imagine a construction site where both people and equipment are recognized as objects by a machine learning system, and then policies are applied to all of them. And these policies and protocols obviously will be determined by the profit-driven interests of the bosses. But unlike the non-digital protocols, they'll be harder to break, even if they're deeply unfair and inhuman. So I think this is a pretty dystopic world that they envisage for us. Oh, shit. Yeah, but I'm running out of time, so I'm going to move on from that. I think people probably can see what's wrong with some of that stuff. But it's worth just saying one of the other arguments is that they say that if we just have enough data, we would be able to overcome all of the key problems in the world. So one of them lists famine, war, economic crisis, and pandemics, actually, as the things that just having a huge amount of sophisticated data analysis would be able to overcome. I think this really doesn't work at all. We don't, like, economic crisis, for example, does not come about because we just have, sorry, my computer's on the fritz, because we just have a lack of data. It comes about because actually the constant investment in new means of production, the constant attempt to raise productivity, and the mad rush to invest in more expensive machinery rather than the value-creating labour of human beings reduces the rate of profit and eventually can cause crashes. And I don't think that just predicting the outcomes of the global economy can actually cut against that. But I'll move on. So the other type of kind of post-capitalist utopia envisaged by some of these people is by Paul Mason and David Harvey. And this is the kind of information wants to be free type of utopia. What they argue is that the new information-based economy can't be controlled by a minority or by monopolies for long because it is all kind of freely created. So all of the software and stuff can just be infinitely replicated. It's basically an infinite resource and it's weightless. So one of the things that Mason argues, for example, is that information is corroding even the market's ability to form prices correctly. And this is just totally wrong, actually. But basically, they think that the prevalence of this new information economy will just break capitalism and capitalism will stop working. And the other part of that, which I've got there as point two, is that while the working class is ceasing to be an actual working class, we are all becoming powerful as content creators in this vast knowledge economy. So every time you post something on Wikipedia, every time you post a piece of free content, you are being a knowledge creator. You can increasingly actually use that to destroy capitalism from the inside. So it's all pretty fantastical, I think. Okay, I think it's really patently absurd. Like, it's why every other part of the capitalist system exists, really. The state, its armed bodies, its courts and property law, its gates and locks and passcodes and secrecy, all of this is why these things can't just be freely owned by everyone. They're owned by actual capitalists. So the economy is not weightless. It is actually owned and controlled by a minority. And as well, it's just totally wrong that all of this, the only kind of thing that is being produced now is information, and that's the only thing that produces value. There are still trillions of commodities being produced every single day, being sold on the market, being transported. And of course, there are still actually the biggest working class of all time, both in relative terms and in absolute terms, has been created by this system. So the idea that, the working class doesn't exist anymore. Yeah, exactly. The working class doesn't exist anymore. We're all just content creators is absolute rubbish. And when you're creating content, you're not actually challenging anything, I don't think. You're certainly not challenging the kind of monopoly and control that these corporations have over the means of production. In fact, it just feeds back into their huge means of data extraction. Okay, but I'll move on from that. Okay, well, just some last points. Like, I guess one question I had while reading this stuff is, are we really that predictable? Because Zuboff kind of goes on and on about how this is going to allow for the kind of total knowability of human behavior, and not just predicting it, but being able to control it on a really fine level. And I just think, like, the data the kind of means that we've talked about really predict us at our most predictable. You know, while we're shopping online or scrolling Facebook or in the workplace where we're just being told what to do every second of the day, but they can't actually predict or much less control social outbursts, collective struggle. Also, just one point is that the scale of the data is so large that they're not really predicting what each individual will do moment to moment. They're predicting that a percentage of a large group of people will do something. And they can do that fairly accurately, but it's not actually the same as having infinite knowledge of every single individual and what they will do. Another question which someone actually asked me the other day is, like, do we live in a digital panopticon? This is a non-digital panopticon. If people don't know what it is, it was a 19th century prison design in which inmates it was designed to make them always feel as though they're being watched and intended to induce this kind of self-disciplining psychology. The interesting thing is that actually even physical panopticons could never really be made to work. Inmates always found ways to communicate with each other. They always took chances to rebel when the risk was worth it, and they always, they still rioted. And consequently, prison wardens had to compromise them, allow them more privacy and dignity, allow misbehavior to go unpunished, and so on. And I think that the same is true of our digital world, a digital panopticon, is that people still rebel literally all the time, even in the harshest censorship and surveillance that exists in the world. As in China, only a few years ago, there were some of the biggest strike waves in the world. Myanmar as well has a huge kind of spying apparatus, and people rebelled against the military dictatorship there. So they can't actually stop us rebelling against injustice or against the, surveillance and panopticon itself. People like Snowden, individual whistleblowers, I think prove that, as well as obviously the more dramatic things of workers' struggles, toppling dictatorships. Okay. Another thing is if it's not a panopticon, does it psychologically numb us? And Zuboff writes a lot about how Facebook kind of does this. There's an always on phenomenon, particularly among adolescents and young people. And I do think she's right that some of the psychological effects of this are deleterious. There are plenty of studies that show this. More and more people feel like they don't exist unless they're online. It encourages people, particularly young women, to constantly compare themselves, their bodies, their personalities, and their lives to others. And people have genuine addictions to things like Facebook, social media, games. And it really is kind of our generation's slot machines, with that it purposely and is designed to exploit certain, parts of human psychology to just generate money for somebody else. And even though we're more connected than ever, people do feel extreme loneliness and depression. And I think this is a horrible contradiction, which really I don't think can be solved within a capitalist system, which always, anyway, reduces us to numbers, uses us, and now it can just use even our most intimate moments and friendships to make money. But again, that's part of capitalism. I'm not a Luddite, obviously. I think a future where we're all connected by a whole very cool tech and maybe some augmented and virtual reality as part of that should be hoped for, but I think you can't actually have that be a world of true human freedom unless it's within a different social system where people are genuine equals and have real democratic control over society. and individual control over their lives as well. Okay, I'm going to start summing up. So Zuboff has a plan to beat surveillance capitalism, and I was kind of shocked when I finally got to the end of her 800-page book to see how moderate and conservative that plan is actually. She calls for us to bet everything on democracy, by which she means the state and the courts, and she makes it clear that only state regulation from above, she thinks, can actually stop surveillance capitalism. And she, like Paul Mason and a lot of others, insists that workers are no longer important to surveillance capitalism, that even us as users of these systems are powerless, and that all hope basically lies with our institutions, i.e. the institutions that literally built a home for these surveillance capitalists to grow rich. So even though she thinks we are in this life or death struggle for a human future, as she puts it, her prescription is so conservative, basically to educate lawmakers about surveillance capitalism's harmfulness and get them to rein in the industry so that we control it. Yeah, and I'm sure this is the very, very conservative conclusion drawn by a lot of authors. And it's connected to her idea as well that the previous form of capitalism, I mentioned this at the start, industrial capitalism, was inherently democratic and based on reciprocity between workers and bosses, and that we should basically aim to return to that previous form. A few things on that. First, we still live in an industrial society, in industrial capitalism, like I said before, with the biggest working class of all time. Second, there was never any reciprocity between the classes before the 21st century. There was always class struggle, and that's how we actually won certain gains, you know, including shorter working days, anti-discrimination laws, and so on. And thirdly, the capitalist state, which she sees carrying out this whole project, isn't actually democratic. It doesn't represent the will of the masses, but the will of the capitalist class as a whole. And sometimes it does regulate certain industries because they're necessary for the smooth running of capitalism, or, you know, for fair play among capitalists, so antitrust laws. And it's possible actually that Facebook and Google are going to be hit with some antitrust laws, which isn't really about us. It's more about other capitalists being annoyed that they have too much wealth. And, you know, there's some regulations obviously that were won by workers in struggle. But I think even if there is some regulation of this high-tech industry, it's not going to actually rob big tech of their power and use all of that data and technology in our interests. It will still be owned and controlled by them. And in a lot of places, the direction things are going is the opposite direction. So in Australia, this was just passed. I didn't even notice, really, a few months ago, which basically allows for totally warrantless surveillance of the Australian population. So just lastly, I think another important battleground of the fight against surveillance capitalists is actually the workplace. In my workplace, for example, the reason I've got trains in there is that we successfully prevented our boss from using CCTV cameras that are in these train cabs. Every single one of them has a giant union sticker covering it. So, you can actually just oppose and fight this kind of constant surveillance and demand a right to dignity. The West Virginia teachers as well won their fight against the introduction of that Fitbit surveillance. The other thing is that the tech industry itself is full of workers. They produce everything. And they actually, because it's a fairly new industry, you know, 20, 25 years old, it wasn't introduced as here are a bunch of unions you can have to organise, go ahead. In fact, the tech giants have always been terrified of unions, and one of the reasons they located themselves in Silicon Valley was because of its anti-union laws. And most of the utopian, you know, dystopian tech writers focus only on the unprecedented power of tech workers, of big tech, but not their workers. You think about the power these workers have, like, internet service provider technicians can literally shut down the whole internet, as could Google's workers, really. And, you know, plenty of amazing things that they could do. And they have actually been starting to fight back. People probably heard some of these stories, and I'll just end on them. So in Google, in 2018, Google fought to end forced arbitration and better sexual harassment policies and to end pay inequality. And they also actually protested against being forced to work on software which would trigger drone strikes. Amazon workers have been getting organised recently as well. Google and Amazon workers fought against selling artificial intelligence and facial recognition technology to the Pentagon, which is very cool. Microsoft workers basically argued against selling cloud computing services to some of the agencies responsible for separating families at the border. A bunch of these workers all joined in the global climate strike and so on. And the Amazon warehouse workers strikes, people should definitely read about because that is all part of this big tech kind of fight back as well. So this image, which is of the Communication Workers of America, this to me is the face of the human future, which Zuboff goes on about so much, but she thinks will come from the pens of enlightened legislators. I think it will come from rebellion and struggle from below. And I think the fight for socialism, where the working class actually controls all these means of production, including the digital ones, is a fight for a world where data and technology is used to actually improve our lives instead of being used against us to improve the profits of capitalists. And I'll leave it there.